You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
Well, I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Thursday, October 10th, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Ian Millhiser, constitutional analyst from the Center for American Progress, on the McCutcheon versus FEC case. Also on the program today, debt ceiling punt. You know what that means. Also, good news on the spreading salmonella front. It seems the CDC is back on the job. Bad news, it's antibiotic resistant. What are you going to do? Also on the program today, Fox News jumps on the SSID bandwagon, Social Security disability insurance, I should say. We'll talk about that story. I know I forgot it yesterday. And check that deed, folks, when you buy that that homestead. You may not own the mineral rights underneath your land. It may be fracked. And meanwhile, 2047, if you're living in New York, that's when the climate will flip, according to a new study. All that and more on today's program. I meant to get to this story yesterday, and I will do so. Before I do, I just want to remind you, still have a couple more days to nominate this program for a podcast award. We won the award in 2011. We won the award in 2012 for Best News in Politics Podcast. If you go to podcastawards.com, you can nominate us once. Voting starts, I think, in a couple of weeks, and then you can vote every day, literally.
It'd be very sad if the podcast that won 2 years straight for politics and news didn't even get nominated.
It is helpful not only in attracting false patent lawsuits, but it also brings a lot of people to the show. So podcastawards.com. Go there, nominate the show if you haven't already, please. And then we'll ask you to vote early and often. All right, this story I teased yesterday, I want to get to it. Conservatives were gathering at the Plaza Hotel in Manhattan Monday night to roast former Vice President Dick Cheney. Now, don't get your hopes up, folks. This is actually one of those more comedic roasts, not to literally put him on the top of some type of fire and, you know, rotate him. The gathering was hosted by Commentary. Is that the Podhoretz's magazine? The figures included former Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, former Attorney General Michael Mukasey, and, of course, my old friend, former Senator Joe Lieberman. Does anybody know what he's doing these days? His joke recalled one person who was there and offended by... Now, remember, these are all supporters. He, quote, said something to the effect that it's nice that we're all here at the plaza instead of cages after some war crimes trial.
That is just bad to begin with, like, just terrible.
I guess it depends on your perspective, because I would have found it a lot nicer if they were, in fact, in cages after a war crimes trial. The event was sponsored by Rupert Murdoch, Paul Singer, starred Joe Lieberman and Scooter Libby, the Cheney aide jailed for lying to investigators in a leak hunt. There were some waterboarding jokes that were really tasteless, said the guest. I can see the case for enhanced interrogation techniques after September 11, but I can't really endorse sitting there drinking wine and fancy dinner at the plaza laughing uproariously about it. What this guest, I think, failed to realize is that they were there feeding a bunch of sociopaths. Other jokes touched on Cheney's having shot a friend in the face. Another attendee said, quote, it was a very sentimental night. I will remind you, there are some European countries where the likes of these men are not allowed to enter without facing war crimes trials. And even, I think, 30 years after McNamara, even after he came out with his apology, you could still find some editorials saying this is a guy who should have been tried in some fashion. So hope springs eternal that these horrible, despicable human beings will get their comeuppance. I wouldn't hold your breath, but really just disgusting. At the very least, I take some comfort that Joe Lieberman, somewhere in the deep right recesses of the bowels of his mind, he somewhere there is something that reminds him, I could be on trial for war crimes. That is a small consolation, perhaps. But I doubt that bowel even exists in the mind of Dick Cheney. But one never knows. Maybe we'll get some type of deathbed apology.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, unlikely. All right, let's take a break, and we'll go talk to Ian Millhiser. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. Ian Millhiser, he is a senior constitutional policy analyst at the Center for American Progress Action Fund and the editor of Think Progress Justice. Welcome to the program, Ian.
It's good to be here. Thanks so much, Sam.
So, Ian, tell us the McCutcheon v. FEC. This case did not get the attention it warrants, I believe, largely in part because, of course, our country is being held hostage by the Republican Party. But that aside, who brought the case and why?
Well, there are two plaintiffs in the case, and of course the most high-profile plaintiff is the Republican Party. The other one is a conservative businessman. And what's at stake here is potentially whether we can still have limits on campaign contributions in this country. We're seeing from this Supreme Court an effort to dismantle our anti-corruption law. The reason why we have campaign finance law is because the Supreme Court said in the 70s that preventing corruption, preventing someone from essentially buying favors from lawmakers is so important that we're going to allow caps on contributions, we're going to allow regulation of those contributions to prevent that sort of corruption from taking place. And in Citizens United, they said, no, that rule doesn't apply anymore for super PACs and these other outside groups. Now they look like they're prepared to say that contributions to parties, maybe even contributions to candidates, this anti-corruption rule may not apply anymore, and it's taking us another step down a path that ends in a world where billionaires can write million-dollar checks straight to candidates, and there's nothing we can do about it.
Okay, so basically what we're seeing is another chink taken out of Buckley v. Valeo, which is that case that you mentioned in the 70s that sort of created our modern campaign finance framework. All right, so tell us what specifically is in question here. There are limits on what an individual can give to a specific candidate, and there's limits on how many candidates an individual can give to.
That's right. So the way that the law works is that you could only give, I think it's $2,600 to an individual candidate. There's a certain amount you're allowed to give to various party organizations. And then there are big caps on the total amount of money that a very wealthy individual is allowed to give to all groups and all candidates. It's about $123,000. That's the most money that a single wealthy individual can spend on candidates and on party groups. And the particular issue in this lawsuit is they want to get rid of that $123,000 cap. So to be clear, the issue here is we are talking about people who have already given 123 grand. And the question is, having already given that much money to try to put the people they want in office, whether the law is able to say, you know what, six figures is enough, or whether that cap's going to be eliminated by the Supreme Court and put us in a world where, through very elaborate money laundering schemes, it'll be possible to funnel a whole lot of money potentially to elect just a single candidate.
And I want to get to that aspect of it, the money laundering, in a moment. But so Buckley v. Valeo, it sets the aggregate at the time at $25,000, and then I guess in 2002. Via campaign reform, it was sort of, inflation adjusted or indexed to inflation. Mm-hmm. But why 25,000? I mean, how was that figure determined?
I mean, I don't know that there was a great deal of thought that went into figuring out the 2,600 per candidate figure. It used to be $1,000. And then when McCain-Feingold was enacted during the Bush administration, there was some reluctance, I think, from some people to sign on to it. And so doubling that $1,000 and making it $2,000 was part of the bargain. It was a sweetener that was open to people who were reluctant to put limits on campaign finance, on campaign financing. And then they also indexed it to inflation. But I don't know if there was an exact calculation. I think the theory is that $2,600 is a lot of money, but it's not so much money that you're going to be able to buy favors with it. You know,
right.
If I'm a candidate and I need to raise $5 million for my race, if someone can write me a $2,600 check, I'm going to like them. It's not going to corrupt me. But if someone can write me a $5 million check, I'm going to do whatever that guy wants.
Okay, and so you have these different types of aggregate limits in terms of what you can give to candidates. What is the value, for instance? You know, it seems that the argument here is two part. One is that Or I guess tell us what the argument for those who want to overturn this is. Obviously, it's that I'm inhibited. If I can only spend $123,000, I don't have the ability to freely express myself and my political views because I may want to give to 100 candidates. But it seems that there were sort of two aspects to this. One is they want to be able to give to more candidates, but they also basically want to be able to give an unlimited amount to groups that then turn around and fund other candidates. And that's where there's sort of the money laundering comes in.
That's right. I mean, there's something very insidious going on here. So it goes back to the Citizens United case. That was the case that said that corporations can give as much money as they want to super PACs and other third-party organizations. The super PACs were actually created by a later decision. But, you know, this whole network of groups that aren't connected to a candidate, that aren't connected to a party, but that are funding, sometimes spending hundreds of millions of dollars to elect people, those were created by Citizens United and some of the decisions that followed from Citizens United.
And we should say that theoretically, at least, and we all know in practice this is sort of a joke, but at least theoretically, those outside expenditure groups are not supposed to coordinate with the campaign, so that they may have aligned interest, but they're not so aligned that they're actually strategizing together.
That's right. That's the theory, is right, that Karl Rove's group and David Koch's group and Sheldon Adelson's group don't actually talk to the candidates. And, you know, if you believe that, then I've got a bridge to sell you. But that's the theory. So what Citizens United did, the core of Citizens United, is it said that it is not corrupting if I write a $1 million check to a third-party organization that's then going to take my $1 million and use it to elect some guy. Somehow, like, that guy's never going to find out that I wrote that check, so he doesn't know that he should be grateful to me and do favors to me. That was the theory behind Citizens United. I don't believe it. That's what the Supreme Court said. What the plaintiffs in this new case are saying, in this McCutcheon case, is they're saying, wait a second. If it's not corrupting to write a $1 million check to a third-party group and then have that $1 million check, you know, be spent on that candidate, and that's not going to lead to him being corrupted, how is it corrupting if you just write that $1 million check to a bunch of Republican Party organizations and then it somehow gets funneled through a money laundering scheme to the candidate? How is that somehow more corrupting than if you write it to a super PAC? And frankly, I think the plaintiffs are right on that point. You know, if you're giving $1 million to elect someone, it doesn't matter what sort of legalistic scheme you use to do it. What matters is that guy's going to find out who wrote him that check, and they are going to know where to lay the wreath of gratefulness, as one of the lower court judges put it. And so the problem is, the Supreme Court created a nonsensical distinction in Citizens United, and they are now looking like they may rely on this completely ridiculous distinction in order to take away some more protections because, you know, they've suddenly figured out that this distinction doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, I mean, it was, I guess, this is one thing that people pointed out here, and I think you wrote a piece about it. Scalia said at one point, and we should say that the oral arguments took place, was it yesterday or no, 2 days ago, Wednesday, Tuesday. Was it October 8th, I think it was.
And yeah, I believe that's right.
And Scalia said, it was fanciful to think that a sense of gratitude that an individual senator or congressman is going to feel because of a substantial contribution to the Republican National Committee or Democratic National Committee is any greater than he would feel for a contribution to a PAC that is spending a lot of money on his election in his district or state. So the idea is that they create, almost out of whole cloth, because there was no facts that were presented to them in the Citizens United case to establish whether or not this money was corrupting by outside expenditures. So they establish in that case that this is not in any way corrupting of our process. And then they turn around and basically cite, hey, look, if it wasn't corrupting in that instance, why should it be corrupting in this instance?
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. I mean, Scalia is right when he says that a huge check given to a super PAC is exactly as corrupting as a huge check given to a bunch of party organizations. The problem is that once you've figured out that they're the exact same thing, the appropriate thing to say is, oh, Citizens United was wrong then. You know, if any way that you come up with to get a huge amount of money to help elect a candidate is just as corrupting as any other way, then this silly distinction that claimed that super PACs are somehow special and that they somehow don't corrupt candidates is wrong. And if the court was going to do the right thing here, they'd say, we screwed up in Citizens United. Citizens United is overruled, and they'd get all this money out of our elections.
And so what are the – and we should also say that the lower court that first decided on this, that threw this out, they did not do any fact-finding either in this instance. They simply ruled that this would be corrupting. And we should say that the judge in that case was Janice Rogers Brown.
Right.
Just tell us about her, because she is one of the most extreme right-wing judges in this entire country, I think. I mean, I don't think that's hyperbole to say that. I mean, she thinks that we're living in a socialist state right now.
That's right. I mean, Janice Rogers Brown is arguably the most conservative, at least the most conservative federal judge in the country. You know, she has called the New Deal a socialist revolution, or the Supreme Court cases that allowed the New Deal a socialist revolution. She's compared liberalism to slavery. She wrote an opinion once that if you take its rationale seriously, it means that all Wall Street regulations, all business regulations, and all labor regulations have to be viewed with extreme skepticism by judges, and most of them are likely to get struck down immediately. That's who this woman is. And even she said that what the Republican Party is asking for in this one lawsuit is too much. We should leave these limits on spending in place. This is, you know, like I said, arguably the most conservative judge in the country. And now the Supreme Court is looking like they're going to tack to her right. I have never heard of a situation where there's a judge looking at Janice Rogers Brown and saying, oh, I think she's too moderate. I think we need to do something even more radical than what the woman who can't tell the difference between liberalism and slavery thinks.
Well, what's fascinating to me in both, I mean, and this was, you know, people spoke about this quite a bit in Citizens United, that particularly people focused on Anthony Kennedy's sort of complete lack of understanding, and we should say there was no facts brought in front of right. these judges. And I think we all have an assumption that if you're a Supreme Court justice, you must know everything about everything, as opposed to the reality, which is there's no reason to believe they have any more understanding of how things work in the real world than anyone else. And in some instances, I mean, just based upon that interview with Antonin Scalia the other day, you know, a guy who says, like, I only get my news from the Washington Times and Hugh Hewitt or whatever it is, Bennett, you know, from talk radio. These guys, Anthony Kennedy said at one point, like, you know, there's no reason to believe that if somebody steps into an election or threatens to step into an election with millions of dollars, that this is going to influence a candidate or a legislator at all. I mean, it's just absurd.
Yeah, and I'll add to that. One of the most remarkable parts about the oral argument on Tuesday was Justice Alito, and Justice Alito is a really smart man. Alito is probably the smartest conservative justice on the court right now, but he's also a really strategic thinker. He's always thinking about what he needs to do to get a more conservative kind of decision in place. And Alito was acting baffled by the idea that if there was a legal way that someone could set up a money laundering scheme, the hypothetical that people kept talking about was a $3.6 million money laundering scheme that would allow that money to pass through to influence candidates. And Alito was baffled by the idea that someone might choose to do that, you know, in the same way that he must have seemed baffled by the idea that before Citizens United, we'd have Sheldon Adelson spending $150 million to elect the candidates that he wants to elect. And I have to think, because Alito is such a smart guy, that he's just being willfully ignorant here. I can't believe he's dumb enough to not understand that if you give people a way to do what they want to do, they will do it. And the entire history of our campaign finance shows that that's the case. I just have to think he was playing ignorant because he thought that that was some strategically the right thing to do.
Explain to us about this money laundering, okay? So basically, walk us through that hypothetical, which seems to me to be quite obvious, but walk us through it.
Sure thing. So, I mean, there's several different schemes that you could set up. One of them is, you know, there's all these alphabet soup organizations. There's the RNC, the Republican National Committee. There's the RSCC. There's the RLCC. And there's all
About basically the Republican Congressional Campaign Committee, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, the Senate campaign committees of both parties, the national parties, on and on.
Right. So there's all these alphabet soup groups, and there's no real limit on the number that either party can create. So if the Democrats wanted to create 1 million alphabet soup groups, or if the Republicans wanted to create 1 million alphabet soup groups, they could. And if you eliminate the limit on the total amount of money you're able to give to all of these alphabet soup groups, then what's going to happen is someone's going to write the maximum amount that's allowed to every single one of them. If there's 1 million of them, I think it's a $5,000 limit on the amount that you can give. So it's 5,000 times 1 million they're allowed to give. And then the rules governing the transfer of money between these organizations are not very strong. The rules governing coordination amongst these groups are not very strong. So once you have distributed this money freely to potentially 1 million different groups, there are many ways that those groups can work together to essentially pool that money to a common end, whether that's to elect a single person, whether that's to elect, you know, to funnel that money to the five most contested Senate races. Whatever they want to do, it's very easy for them to work together to do it. And so that's how the money laundering schemes work, is that you set up a scheme where it looks like you're writing a bunch of different checks to a bunch of different groups, but in reality, the way that that money is going to be used is it's going to be used all for the same purpose. And it's, you know, easy to imagine a donor having that purpose in mind when they write the check.
So, all right, so people have to sort of see the sleight of hand that's taking place here. We're going to say that specific limits on what you can give to these groups stay intact, but we're going to say that we're going to promulgate the number of these groups so that without any type of cap on how much you can give in total, you could just keep making all these groups, and the idea that these groups wouldn't coordinate is absolutely silly. I mean, if I'm Sheldon Adelson, if I'm the Koch brothers, if I'm, you know, I guess George Soros, and I say, look, I'm going to give you guys 5,000. I think you know what this is going to go towards. And then these groups get together and go, if we want to keep Mr. Soros happy, who's just given us $1 billion, we will focus it towards this candidate or these specific races. And, you know, money's fungible. It's money we don't have to spend on those races. We'll get the money for the other for the other races. I mean, that's basically the plan, right?
That's right. Yeah, the idea is that, you know, it allows a smart party and a smart donor to work out a scheme that ends up with enormous amounts of money going to, you know, going to whatever purpose they want. And of course, you know, because the way that this last oral argument played out is they said, well, this distinction between this case and Citizens United doesn't make any sense. So let's just tear down the wall. Let's just tear down one wall and make our campaign finance laws even weaker. The minute these money laundering schemes pop up, I tell you what the next lawsuit is going to be. The next lawsuit is going to be, well, if we're already allowing a money laundering scheme that allows a donor to give a $3 million check to someone through some elaborately complex Rube Goldberg machine, why do we do it that way? Why don't we just let him write the check directly? It doesn't make sense to force people to jump through all these stupid hoops. And that's a pretty good argument. If you allow the elaborate money laundering scheme, why not just make it easy? I can't think of a good reason to require these elaborate schemes. And so the Supreme Court will then strike down the limit on the amount you can give directly to candidates, and we won't have any meaningful campaign finance law at that point. The idea is you start with a ridiculous premise. The premise that money given to super PACs and the like doesn't corrupt anyone. And then that premise takes you to the point where these caps that are at stake in this McCutcheon case don't make any sense. And that takes you to the point where the next law doesn't make any sense. And unless you look back and realize that the problem is that Citizens United was wrong, then you can go all the way down this rabbit hole.
And there was an interesting piece by Lawrence Lessig today saying that, you know, the Solicitor General for the Obama administration sort of missed an argument that could have been useful, and that being that the narrowness in which the court is looking at the idea of corruption, that it is just about quid pro quo for the corruption of individuals, misses the point of what the framers of the Constitution meant when they said corruption. He said that Lessig wrote that 57% of the times when the framers used the word corruption, they were speaking of institutions. And the one clear and repeated example was an institution that had developed an improper dependence on, in the instance of the Parliament in Great Britain, on the King, as opposed to, or it could be applied to an improper dependence on an elite group of wealthy people. And yep. It is quite clear that if you, even if you don't even have to argue that all this money is going to end up earmarked in one or two or three or four. I mean, if you have enough money, you could fund 100 races well beyond the limits of what the supposed caps impose. But that it corrupts the system as a whole because, again, if there are no limits, even in the aggregate, you're still going to end up relying on, I don't know, 100, on 500, on 1,000, on 2,000, on an infinitesimally small number of people who have the capacity to give way beyond what the vast majority of Americans, even in the aggregate, could give.
Right. Yeah, no, you want to talk about dependence in the way that Lessig was describing it there. The average member of Congress spends a third of their time dialing for dollars and doing other stuff to raise money. As much as 4, 5, 6 hours a day, every single member of Congress is trying to get some more bucks out of people. And even if they are raising that money from angels, even if they are raising that money from people who want nothing in return, who ask nothing in return, and want nothing but to make sure that the government cures poverty and eliminates cancer, if that's how they're getting all that money, if you're spending 6 hours a day raising money, you know what you aren't doing? You aren't learning about the bills you're voting on. You aren't speaking to the rest of your constituents to find out what their concerns are. You aren't thinking about what your policy objectives should be. You aren't learning about economics. You aren't learning about health policy. You aren't learning about national security so you can cast intelligent votes in the future. What you are doing is you are turning yourself into an ignorant fundraising machine, not because you're stupid, but because it's the only thing you have time to do. And I don't want that person making laws for me. I want someone who has actually taken the time to sit down and be thoughtful about what they're voting on and who has the time to sit down and be thoughtful about what they're voting on. And if they're spending 6 hours a day raising money, they're not going to be able to do it.
We had, I think it was last week on this program, maybe it was earlier this week, I can't even remember, Martin Gillen's on, who's done sort of the seminal research on the influence that money has had on our policy over the past 30 or 40 years. Boils down to, in every policy conflict, regardless of who's in power, regardless of which party is in power, the policy preferences, if there is a conflict, always, always fall to the side of the wealthy as opposed to the vast majority of Americans. This is not going to help the situation in any way, of course. And it's odd just that this type of data is not introduced in a case like this. I mean, if you're measuring the corrupting influence, and never mind the idea of, you know, corruption as narrowly defined as bribery, but if you're measuring the corrupting influence, it seems completely and utterly, you know, sort of malpractice. Obviously, facts are not, you don't argue facts at the Supreme Court level. But if you're going to make a determination of this sort as to whether or not this is corrupting, you need those facts, at least in the record. They're not even in the record.
Right.
Where do you think this case, I mean, who will be the, assuming that we have another 5-4 type of ruling, and maybe that's not the case, but give me your sense, read the tea leaves if you can.
Sure. So the justice to watch is Chief Justice Roberts. At the oral argument, Roberts was more hesitant than the other conservatives to go all the way. But the fact that he's not willing to go all the way may not get us that much. So Roberts seemed to agree that if someone wants to give $3 million and set up an elaborate money laundering scheme to do that, that shouldn't be allowed. But he also seemed to think that the current limits, which, you know, for candidates is about $50,000, that was too low. And I don't know if he thinks that maybe people should be able to give $70,000 or $80,000. I don't know where he thinks the line is. So, but the problem is that if Roberts strikes down these limits and says these don't work, Congress go back and come up with another number than we like better, the same thing is going to happen there that we're seeing happening after the Voting Rights Act case that he just decided, where Robert said, yeah, the way that you've done the Voting Rights Act isn't right. Congress, if you want to fix it, go ahead. Well, Congress can't tie its shoes right now. We're actually having a debate right now over whether or not Congress is going to disarm a time bomb that will blow up our entire nation's economy. Like, that's how dysfunctional Congress is. If Roberts strikes down these limits, even if it would be really easy to write a law that would put most of the limits back, that law's never passing, you know, at least not with these members.
So, in other words, it's I don't have a problem with the concept. I just don't like the formula. If you can come up with a better formula, then we will reinstitute these limits. But until that day, it's just everybody have a free ride.
Yeah, and it points to a broader problem we have with our Supreme Court right now. You know, last term, the Supreme Court dismantled most of our law protecting people from sexual harassment. It dismantled much of our law protecting people from other forms of discrimination. And Congress could at any minute go back and say, you know what, I think sexual harassment's a problem, and we're going to fix what the Supreme Court just broke, but they aren't going to do it.
Right.
Because, again, you know, Congress can't figure out whether or not it wants to open the government. How are we going to get them to agree to do anything else?
Ian Mielheiser from the Center for American Progress Action Fund, I appreciate your time today.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Sam.
All right, folks, we're going to head into the better half of the program, wherein just the news is just really, do we have some happy stories?
I don't think so.
I don't think we do either, frankly.
You killed happy story suggestions in,
oh, that's true. You
I did kill the happy story. It wasn't so much. I mean, it was,
inspiring.
You're talking about the inspiring Yeah, maybe we should just play that clip.
I wasn't actually. I was just trying to make kind of a joke. I wasn't trying to get
all right, that Michael. Clip. All right.
That clip is the context. We're talking about the clip of Malala, who's that girl who was shot by the Taliban in Pakistan, and she did a pretty incredible interview the other day on Jon Stewart. But it, I mean, it's inspiring.
Let's link to it. Let's link to it. I'll link to it. I'll link to it on the blog at majority.fm. Less inspiring stories in the better half. We'll talk about the Salmonella outbreak. We'll talk about the implications. I mean, we have mentioned this sort of in passing, and maybe we're talking about having somebody on the show to talk about the school situation in Philadelphia. The Pennsylvania government has basically has been running the school system in Philadelphia for years now, and they went through another round of cuts. The Salmonella outbreak is an example of the implications and what we are vulnerable to when you see a government shutdown and you see these type of cuts, despite the fact that I think our libertarian and our Republican friends would have us believe that these are just a bunch of useless bureaucrats. Well, Governor Corbett in Pennsylvania cut another bunch of useless so-called bureaucrats in schools, eliminated funding for full-time nurses at schools, and it appears to have led directly to the death of a student. It's just a horrible story. We'll talk about it when we get back. Also, we'll take on that 60 Minutes hit piece on Social Security disability, which, of course, is now we see echoed on Fox News with John Stossel. We will talk about that as well. And the story of the latest sort of breakdown on the climate change numbers, and by 2047, we could see a situation in many parts of this country where the coldest year is warmer than the warmest year we have experienced. I'll explain when we return. The number is 646-257-3920. Folks, if you want to support this program, and I hope you do, become a member today at majority.fm. Not only do you get an extra 50 minutes of material a day, of content, of stories that we go through, some days they're more in-depth than others, but you also support the first half of this program, which, you know, we release for free because we want to amplify the voices of the people that we have on here. We want to put out good information and news and interviews on topics of the day, the week, the month, the year, the era. And if you have the financial means to support the program and you listen to the program on a daily basis, maybe you do it through the app, which you can get at majorityapp.com. Maybe you do it through your computer or iTunes or whatever it is. Please support the program if you can. You can support it by going to Podcast Awards and giving us a nomination. You can support it by going to majority.fm/review and giving us a review on iTunes. You can support it by buying your Amazon junk through our Amazon link, but becoming a member is obviously the best way to show your support for this program and the best way to literally support it. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Get a 10% coupon code, majority, get 10% off. All right, we'll see you in the better half. The IM machine is up. Phones are working. 646-257-3920. We'll see you in a minute. Say to that